Hello.
And welcome
to My Favorite Murder,
the podcast you listen to sometimes.
Right? That's Karen Kilgariff.
That's Georgia Hardstark.
Hi. I haven't left the house in many days.
Oh, I just left today.
Oh, what's it like out there?
Start the 2 week count today. Snow traffic.
Yeah. Beautiful skies.
Oh, listen, right before I came into the my office to, because the one carpeted room in the house, I was sitting at the kitchen table and all of a sudden the whole living room smelled like jasmine.
Oh,
it was
amazing.
Crazy. I mean, the air quality is so amazing in Los Angeles in ways it never has been before.
Absolutely. It's so beautiful. I've been going on my patio every couple days or every so often and just sitting in the sun. And that has been like the highlight of my week, is just that like 20 minutes of sun. Oh, God. It's so nice.
Oh, my God. You should up that to 30 minutes if you like it that much.
I should.
Go ahead. Give yourself that gift.
I miss the fucking world, which I never thought I'd say or feel.
I mean, it's the exact opposite of what you've been saying to me for the past 2 years. I'm like, I just want to be at home and get sit with my cats. I'm like, now you get it.
But I want it to be voluntary.
You should have said that the first time.
I know.
When you're manifesting, you have to be really specific to the universe.
Shit.
They'll just take you at
your
word.
And then I also have to, the problem is that it's spring as well, and there's this fucking bird in heat that's living in the tree outside of my house.
Not in heat.
It's, what do they get? It's trying to mate, whatever.
I don't know.
And just it will
to get
not,
attention.
Yeah, it won't stop. Like trying to get like whistling and making all these bird sounds all fucking night. I have not been sleeping well. Hold on, Stephen. It's 8 o'clock, so everyone's losing their shit again.
Oh yeah.
Let's see if we can hear it this time. You couldn't hear it last time, right?
No.
I've never heard this.
Hold on. You hear that?
Yeah, a little something.
Kinda, yeah.
A little something in the background. I love that people do that.
It's really nice. Vince tried to play the Star Spangled Banner really loud on his phone the other night. So yeah, I haven't been sleeping well because of this fucking bird, and you know, that's it.
I mean, that's kind of the thing that symbolizes, or like the audio cue that it's like, oh, the morning, like da 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 da, and then bird tweeting, but it's happening all night long.
It's really eerie to hear a bird just tweet all fucking night. It definitely sounds like the beginning of the apocalypse.
Well, yeah, it's off, right? This morning I was on the phone with my dad in the kitchen, and out the front window, a kitchen window, something caught my eye, and I look over, and this gigantic grasshopper is climbing up to get onto the windowsill outside. But I'm telling you that the head of the grasshopper was like the size of a dime.
Oh my God.
Like it's the head alone caught my eye.
Man, and animals are taking back their fucking
planet. They're coming back big time. This thing, I'm going to send you a picture of it. I actually caught a picture as it was lifting its leg up to like get its, and it looks like it's coming to fight me. Like through the window. It's huge. It was a grasshopper that was this big, like 2 inches long. It was insane.
Oh my God. They're coming back. I heard in Yosemite, like the bears are having a fucking field day. They're like running around in the streets and shit because there's not a bunch of fucking tourists there anymore.
That's right.
Living
and they already aren't that afraid of tourists. You know what I mean? They're like kind of used to them. So now they're just like, what? Hello. Like now we get to use this bench? Great.
I'm going to sit on this.
I discovered this today too because I drank a ton of coffee today. Then right around 5 o'clock, I realized the last couple times we've recorded, because I've been like, oh, I don't know if I have it to give. And it's so hard to podcast alone and from home and not in the same room. I realized the missing ingredient has been coffee this entire time.
Oh.
I just need like four solid large ventis of Starbucks and I can podcast through anything.
This is going to be a 5-hour episode, everyone.
I have so much to tell you. You're the first people I've talked to in 3 weeks. I just, when we were trying to set up, You hadn't come on the Zoom yet, but I had I had to jump back off because there was a man standing in front of the window waving. And so I was like,
no.
Oh, hello. What's this? And so he's waving and pointing and So I just go over to my to the window in this room and open it up because I've taken all the screens off of it. I open it up and I'm leaning out the window. I'm like, hi, what's your name? Whatever. And he's kind of talking to me. He has a little bit of an accent.
He's like, it a grasshopper in a suit?
It was an old man version of the grasshopper. He had finally transformed into his final form. No, but he was like basically saying, I'm your neighbor. We haven't met yet. But he said, what's your name? And I said, my name's Karen. And then he went, you're so beautiful.
Oh.
He yelled, you're so beautiful. And I swear to God, I almost burst into tears. And I was like, I'm up. And I was like, first, I haven't put on makeup in so long.
No, like, absolutely
that
not.
Is a blatant lie. My roots are... The gray roots make it look like I'm going bald, blah, blah, blah. But I realize it's because I'm leaning halfway out a window like Rapunzel. You know what I mean? Like I tricked him into saying that to me, basically, because I was like leaning out a window like, sir, what's your name?
And you have like grasshoppers like flying into your hand and you're just, you know, fucking Snow Whiting it up.
Then suddenly the grasshopper's on my shoulder and he's got a little top hat on. Hey, well, and then he actually said, are you married? And I went, divorced. And then he felt bad. So he said, you're so beautiful in this great accent. It was hilarious.
So now he lives with you.
Yeah. So that's my new roommate. I mean, we can only go over what's been happening, and all of the things that have been happening have been either directly outside our door or inside the house.
Or on the computer. I keep having these like Zoom happy hour hangs with like, well, some of our friends will get together and want to have these happy hours, and I hate them and they're so awkward, and I end up getting shit-faced because I'm so uncomfortable and nervous with them, and Vince hates them too. And I realized I was finally able to let him know what it's like for me at a regular in-person hang, is how he feels on a Zoom call, all awkward and weird and having to make weird conversation is my every interaction. So it's kind of like actually this moment that we shared.
Good.
Where he finally got how uncomfortable I am in front of people.
Now, do you have a delay where when you clap, other people clap a second later in real life?
No.
Like, that's basically your problem.
Oh, maybe that's why
you're
awkward.
On a delay. Everyone's beat behind you, and it's so irritating.
They just stare at me. Oh, God. Do you have any news, any updates, any suggestions?
Oh, you want to talk about TV stuff? Stuff you've been watching?
Sure. Sure.
Well, I'm really excited because the people who made Downton Abbey have a new series on Epix. It's called Belgravia or Belgravia, perhaps. I'm not sure. But it's so fucking good. The second episode was on Sunday night. And it like, so just for all the people, this is like, I don't know what version of this is. I don't know if it's Victorian England. It's early 1800s. I'm not sure what the brackets are, but it's great outfits. It's all the great actors, all the like great British period piece actors that you've seen in a ton of stuff are in this, including Tasman Grieg, who actually is more of a comedy person. She was on, did you ever see Episodes, that Matt LeBlanc series with the two British writers? She's the woman from that. But she was also on Friday Night Dinner, which is one of my favorites, Robert Popper's series that was so funny. She was the mom on Friday Night Dinner. And she plays the lead person on this. And with Harriet Walker, I believe her name is, who is just the badass. Is it Harriet Walker? I'm sorry, Harriet Walter. Harriet Walter. Anyway, if you like period pieces and you're into all that kind of stuff, I love Belgravia so far. They've set up a real good... The drama is already in. We're like, there's nothing...
I'm into that.
I love a soap opera from the Victorian age. That's all
I usually
want.
But I loved Downton Abbey, especially the first season, so much that it was surprising to me how into it I was.
It's really well done. And it's like the interesting, like the dynamics are interesting because it's not, it's stuff that we're not as used to, you know what I mean? The dynamics of having a you know, a valet or a footman or a
maid.
Oh,
you don't know what that's like?
Oh, how is it? Good times?
Oh, it's so good.
Oh my God, the politics of the footman. But yeah, so if people are into that, I also was watching The Pickwick Papers, which is a 70s BBC series based on the Dickens novel. And it's like something they would bring in on a rainy day and make you watch in like British lit class when you like against your will. But I found it so delightful. That's just, I guess that's like British accents are my background comfort sounds.
You'll love it. You're going to move there one day, I bet.
Maybe.
Retire to the British countryside.
Oh, just get my own manor house in Footman.
Yeah,
and Valley.
That's right.
But then I'm on the staff because that's really my roots. That's where my people are actually from. My grandmother was a maid for years.
You can't stay out of the kitchen trying to help.
I'm down there like, you should be doing it like this.
Yeah. She's just like everyone else.
She's so down to earth.
She's so down to earth.
What have you been watching?
I've been watching a period piece too, but it's 1940s, which is like my favorite for like set design and clothing and stuff. So it's called The Plot Against America.
I saw the promo for that.
It's our friend and murderino Zoe Kazan, who's so fucking talented, and it's a really good show. And then also randomly, Winona Ryder is like a 1940s New York Jew in it.
I hear she's great in it.
Yeah. And then what's his name, who's so incredible, John Turturro. It's just like a really good quiet show. I feel like people would be people should be screaming about it.
Yeah, I like it.
That's awesome. Yeah. And then, I mean, that's it. I've just been waiting till 5 to start drinking and
good. The little small steps.
Yeah. Garage hangs and trying to keep it together. I had therapy yesterday on the phone, which is like getting good and deep.
Yeah. I was talking to my therapist about all these things we talk about, I then get off the phone and have all this time to think about and work on.
Right.
Because I know I'm going to talk to you again very soon.
Yeah.
And it's not like I can be like, oh, sorry, I didn't watch that. I didn't read that article or whatever. It's like, it's all I have to do.
Yeah.
It's really think about some of this stuff and face it. Why not?
My therapist gave me like a worksheet, like homework, to be like, with your negative thoughts, when you have them, write down like where it came from. What are you thinking? Why do you think this happened? And I did it. I did one, and I'm like not a homework person. Obviously, I barely graduated high school, but I did one after last week, after the podcast, of just like, how do I feel? And it helped. But then I got mad at myself for feeling those things. So that doesn't help.
And then it also doesn't help that then you're judging it from that, like coning all the way out there. Yeah.
Right.
Give yourself a goddamn break.
I'm going to.
Yeah. My therapist gave me homework too. And it was like send a thank you note to yourself, this part of yourself. And then I was just like,
I'm
pretty sure this is not going to happen.
I know.
She also told
me to scream in a pillow. And I'm like, that's embarrassing. What if Vince catches me screaming into a pillow?
Better than screaming into his face. Come on.
Pick one. You only have one.
Pick one. Get a pillow. Go into the garage. Make it part of garage hangs.
Okay.
Make it part of the fun.
I'm into it. I'll have a white claw in one hand and a pillow over my face in the other.
Maybe that's what you need for like social things when you finally do get to socialize again. If you just have a small pillow to scream in, you're just like, how are you? I know. Have you seen the latest episode? Oh, excuse me. I'm sorry. One second. Turn away.
Yeah.
Sorry, I'm back.
Who's that girl who just carries a pillow around with her?
I don't know. She's fascinating.
Don't worry about it.
I'm going to start doing that too. Just be a trendsetter. Should we do some network news?
Oh, yeah. Okay, we're going to do some real quick Exactly Right Network updates for you.
Well, I mean, the big one is just that finally our the brand new weird news comedy show, Bananas, premiered
this week.
I always want to say today because that's real.
Yeah, but, Tuesday.
But it was Tuesday.
Today.
Yes.
Yeah. So please subscribe and listen to Bananas, starring our friends Scotty Landis and Kurt Braunohler. They have the hilarious Kristen Schaal on this week, and she's so delightful.
Hilarious. Truly.
Yeah.
I mean, it's Louise Belcher's on their first podcast. What more do you want as a selling point to listen to this? And also, it's like the perfect escape, hilarious comedy people chatting, being chill, just
talking
being
about
friends
weird shit
and laughing together. That's balm for the soul. You got to do
it. After you listen to your whatever news podcast you listen to, why don't you hop on over to Bananas and soothe your soul a little bit?
Counterbalance that.
That's
make
right.
sure to always counterbalance.
We're your therapist now, and that's your homework.
That's right.
And then the Purrcast, our good friends, Steven and Sarah, have Yardley Smith as a guest this week, which I think is so rad from The Simpsons. Wait, we have Lisa Simpson and we have
Louise Belcher.
Yeah.
All the animated heroes. All
of
my animated superheroes. Now, Yardley Smith is on for Small Town Dicks, right? Or is that what she promotes when she does stuff like
she's
that?
She's the co-host of Small Town Dicks.
Yeah. Which is an amazing podcast if you haven't listened.
No, she was great. And she has like a little sneak peek is that she basically built like a designer cat jungle gym that goes all the way up the stairs in her house.
Amazing.
And it's one of the most, the way she describes it is amazing.
I mean, because it's just great to listen to her voice anyway. But
oh my God, it was incredible.
So awesome. It's just thrilling that she's even a part of anything we do. We're honored.
In our world. Yeah. She's in our world.
So nice booking, so Steven.
Cool. Yeah.
She was the best.
All right. I think that's it for the network news, right? We're doing highlights now, so we don't have to walk everybody through every single thing. If you want more information about what's going on Exactly Right, you can go to our website, which I'm assuming is www.exactlyright.com.
Or media. Exactly Right Media?
Who would know?
It's Exactly Right Media.
.com.biz.
Yes.
.edu.
We're professionals.
Take a look at our website. Have you ever seen the network website? It's fun.
Good. Great. Thank you. There's a video. We're doing videos now of the mini-sodes on our website, myfavoritemurder.com. So you can check those out if you want to see what we look like when we're talking.
All right.
So you're first this week?
Uh-huh.
Okay. Then I won't drink too much of this very weird sweating vodka soda.
I'm doing the crash of PSA Flight 1771. So this is December 7th, 1987.
Okay.
So we're at LAX. 48-year-old man named Ray Thompson boards flight PSA 1771 for San Francisco. He works in the LA office of US Air, but he lives in Tiburon. He's a very high-level US Air manager.
That's Northern California, right?
Yeah, Tiburon is the super rich city it's right above Sausalito, and Sausalito is the first city over the Golden Gate Bridge. So it's like the third city over the Golden Gate Bridge.
Ooh.
Very exclusive, super, super fancy.
Okay.
And it's, I mean, he has the life. That's very cool. You live in LA and then you just commute home on a flight and go to Tiburon. Like, awesome. Okay, so that's his commuter flight. That's what he does to commute to work. So flight 1771 takes off from LAX at 3:31 p.m. Now, this is the flight, not PSA, obviously. I usually do the Southwest version. It takes an hour. You know, the flight time is a little over an hour. So you basically have enough time to get served a drink, finish the drink, and then hand the drink back, and you've landed. It's a dream come true. It's scheduled to land at San Francisco Airport at 4:43 p.m.
Okay.
But about halfway through the flight, air traffic control receives a distress call from First Officer James Nunn in the cockpit. They hear him say over the radio, quote, "There's gunfire on board. We're going down."
Holy shit.
They hear a commotion. They hear a bunch of other stuff. Then a really intense, high-pitched screeching sound, and then silence. 2 minutes later, 22,000 feet over a small town called Templeton, California. I've never heard of it in my life.
Never heard of it. Nope.
You know where it is? It's in the mountain range that's basically San Luis Obispo is on the west side of it. And then like all those vineyardy towns are on the east side of it. In the valley part where all the wine is planted. And then all the wine has been planted in bottles in the ground and grows up. San Ysidro or San, no, that's, sorry.
Napa, all that shit.
No. We're still down by San Luis Obispo.
Paso so it's Robles?
Thank you, Paso Robles. That's what I was trying to think of. Thank you, Steven.
Vince and I got married in San Luis Obispo and then went to Paso Robles for our honeymoon.
Isn't it gorgeous? So this plane takes an almost vertical nosedive. It was going at a 70-degree angle downward.
Oh, my God.
And it crashes into a rocky hillside in a cow pasture, miraculously.
Yeah.
It was outside, just outside of town. Thank God.
Yeah.
The plane dove so fast, it broke the sound barrier. And when it impacted, on impact, it was obliterated into millions of pieces, and it killed all 43 souls on board.
Oh.
So a CBS News helicopter was the first to spot the wreckage, and they alert the authorities. And so there's this TV show I'm about to talk about. It's called Mayday, and it's about plane crashes. I don't know why anyone would watch it, but you should, I guess. But also, of course, Murderpedia articles from the time, from 1987, from the LA Times, the Washington Post, AP News, and Time Magazine had an article about it. Okay, so they use video on that TV show Mayday. It looks like it must be like the video from the Sheriff's Department or something, because it's just like, it's basically a far away full screen shot where they're kind of scanning this field that goes up into like a foothill. And it looks like somebody has just thrown a bunch of pieces of paper everywhere.
Yeah, just debris is only left.
And it's very small, small debris. And the San Luis Obispo County Sheriff's Office detective, Bill Womack, he's quoted in that video as saying about this crash site, quote, "We saw nothing that resembled an airliner. We went on for hours before we heard the news reports of a missing airliner, believing that we were dealing with a small airplane full of newspapers that had crashed. We saw no pieces of the aircraft that were larger than maybe a human hand. It did not look like a passenger aircraft." So when they finally found the crash site, they assumed that it was just like a small plane, because everything was so tiny. And when you see this video, it's mind boggling that it was a full size passenger airplane.
Mm-hmm.
So for the next 2 days, the investigative team digs through the rubble for evidence of what went wrong. So aside from the cockpit voice recorder, which all commercial planes have to record audio in case of emergency situations, they find two very important pieces of evidence. Fragments of a Smith & Wesson 44 Magnum revolver.
How do they find that?
It's in the video too. You see a guy with this, like a stick or a pen or something.
Yeah.
Go like this. And it's not even the whole gun. It's just pieces. Wow. The piece of the gun with the trigger and the round part.
Yeah.
Part of it.
Yeah.
Cartridge. I was going to say cartridge. But essentially they find that it has six empty cartridge cases. They also find a note that was written on an air sick bag that somehow managed to survive the crash. And that note read, quote, "Hi, Ray. I think it's sort of ironical that we end up like this. I asked for some leniency for my family. Remember? Well, I got none and you'll get none." End quote.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. So investigators look at the gun fragments and they end up finding near the trigger part a fingertip that's stuck inside.
Oh, no.
Yeah. And then they fingerprint that fingertip and it identifies that the finger belongs to 35-year-old recently fired U.S. Air employee David Burke.
Wow.
Yes. Because part of the thing about when, and I'm sure lots of people have seen that, like airplane crash sites, they go through and like put little flags next to each piece of debris, because they're categorizing all of it or whatever. Like, so although everything they have to search this field, and apparently I read somewhere, I don't know if it was verified, but they said that there was debris from this crash that was found 8 miles away.
Oh my God.
Because it crashed with such force,
right,
that it was just like boom, like just, you know, the way
you wouldn't
it went
think
out.
A passenger plane like that would get high enough to break the sound barrier when it crashed, which just shows how much force.
Well, yes, because I think
they don't go that high, right?
22,000 feet.
It's pretty high. Know.
But also, I think it's the what happened in it and the way it crashed, because it didn't go back and forth. It didn't. Right. There was no pulling
turbulence
up at any point. Yeah. It just went straight. It nosedived down into the ground and exploded.
Okay.
Okay. So let's talk about this U.S. Air employee, David Burke. He was born in the U.K. His parents were Jamaican. The family immigrates to Rochester, New York, where his father gets a job as a cab driver. So that's where he grows up with his two brothers, who would later describe David as a generous person who, quote, always looks out for the well-being of the family. So David ends up getting a job working at US Air. US Air will eventually be absorbed into American Airlines in 2015. So that US Air was around for a pretty long time.
Yeah, I remember that.
And PSA was like one of the branches of US Air, I guess.
Okay.
So David gets a job working for US Air in Rochester in 1972, and he works there for 14 years. But in 1986, he becomes a suspect in an alleged drug smuggling ring that brought cocaine from Jamaica to the U.S. on U.S. air flights. He was never officially charged for that alleged involvement, but he ends up putting in a transfer to Los Angeles just to get out of town and get away from the allegations. So he could have been completely innocent of that and just like it could have been profiling, could have been anything. But he was like, I'm going to get out of town. He also had a girlfriend who lived in the LA area named Jacqueline Camacho, and she also worked for US Air as a ticket agent. So the move allows him to be, David, to be closer to her. He gets himself a 3-bedroom condo in Long Beach and works out of Terminal 1 in LAX. Around that time, US Air acquires Pacific Southwest Airlines, which everyone calls PSA. Which I spent my childhood watching commercials for, but now is like non-existent, and anyone younger than me has no idea what it is. Just like everything else. Okay, so by July of 1987, things are starting to sour for David at work. Two of his coworkers with less experience than him get promoted to supervisor positions over him in the customer service department. He feels he's been slighted because he's black, because these coworkers are white, and he blames his boss, Ray Thompson, for that. In fact, he actually brings this complaint to the California State Department of Fair Employment and Housing that same month. But before the paperwork officially gets filed, he changes his mind and decides not to file a formal complaint. And that's the last the State Department hears about it. I don't think that it's not like that means that complaint is any less valid. I think it's like you make that complaint and then what happens? You're still at that job, you know?
Right.
So
the regulations weren't there or in place to not get in trouble for even reporting it, probably.
Right, exactly. Like you're going to be a whistleblower, then you're just going to lose everything, you know?
Yeah.
Whatever. For whatever reason, he changes his mind. Then on November 15th, 1987, a hidden camera catches David stealing $69 from flight cocktail receipts. So Ray Thompson, David's supervisor, confronts him about it and tells him US Air is considering filing a misdemeanor charge against him for it. Those charges are never filed, but 4 days later, on November 19th, 1987, Ray Thompson fires David Burke. So in the weeks following his termination, David's girlfriend notices that he's becoming moodier and more violent. On December 4th, 1987, David actually forces Jacqueline and her 6-year-old daughter into his car at gunpoint and drives them around for 6 hours.
Oh my God.
Neither are injured. Jacqueline does wind up filing a report of assault with the police. Then on December 7th, 1987, David visits Ray's office in Terminal 1 at LAX to beg him for his job back, and Ray refuses. He ushers David out of his office, telling him to have a nice day. And David fires back, "I intend on having a very good day." So after he leaves Ray's office, David goes down and buys a one-way ticket for PSA Flight 1771. It's set to leave that same day, December 7th, at 3:31. And he knows that this is the flight that Ray Thompson takes to go home. So even though he was fired, no one took his employee badge. So on his way to the gate, he just shows his credential to his former coworkers at the security gate, and they just let him go right through. They had not been notified. They didn't know he had been fired.
Right.
And they would have never suspected that he was hiding a 44 Magnum on his person that he had borrowed from a now former coworker. They had no idea any of that was going on. And right before he boarded the flight, David called Jacqueline and leaves her a voicemail. And he says, quote, "Jackie, this is David. I'm on my way to San Francisco, flight 1771. I love you. I really wish I could say more, but I do love you." So that's the message that she ends up getting at 9 o'clock that night, like 5 hours after the crash.
Whoa.
Yeah. So basically, obviously, there's no survivors from this flight and from this crash. And investigators have to piece together all of the events of what may have taken place that day based on what they could hear on the voice recorder. So this is, most of it is like conjecture, but it is pretty fascinating how much they can hear and like where the microphones are in the cabin. So they can hear a lot of stuff. Okay. So basically, at some point, you know, during the flight, David takes that air sick bag that was in the CPAC in front of him, writes the note to his boss who just fired him. Then he gets up from his seat. He drops that note onto Ray Thompson's lap and then goes into the bathroom. Basically, yeah, sends him that message. And that not only gives Ray time to read what the note says, it also gives David time to get the gun ready.
Oh, my God.
So he comes out of the bathroom, walks up to Ray's seat, fires twice. The gunshots are heard on the audio recorder. And then at that point, First Officer James Nunn calls radios air traffic control and reports that shots have been fired. Mm-hmm. So now they pick up the sound of the cockpit door opening, and flight attendant Deborah Neal tells the pilot, Captain Greg Lindemood, "We have a problem." And Captain Lindemood says, "What's the problem?" Then another gunshot is heard, and that's David shooting Deborah in the back, followed by David Burke saying, "I'm the problem."
Oh, my God.
Yeah. So then he fires two more times, presumably once at Captain Lindemood and once at First Officer Nunn. And they're both either killed or badly wounded. And now there's this high-pitched screeching sound, which they believe is caused by either one or more bullet holes in the windshield. I'm sure they don't call it a windshield on a plane, but that's...
Sure. I get what you mean. Windshield. Yeah.
That sound begins to grow louder, indicating the plane's rapid descent. Uh-huh. And then another gunshot is heard. Some people theorize it was David Burke killing himself. Others think it's more likely that that was for Captain Douglas Arthur, who was on board as a passenger, and he was PSA's chief pilot in Los Angeles.
Oh, shit.
He was just riding on that plane, too, and they believe he probably approached the cockpit to try and help stop David and try to help the other pilots.
Yeah.
Because the piece of David's finger was found lodged in the trigger guard, forensics experts think that means David was alive and holding the gun at the moment of impact.
Yeah.
But it's all theory. Either way, this gunshot is the last sound recorded on the CVR before the crash.
What?
Yeah. So apparently from that, this clip from Mayday of the people that were at this site, there's one of the guys said, having been one of the investigators, said there was no seats, there was no fuselage, there was no tail of the plane. There was nothing that would indicate a plane was in this spot. That's how tiny all these pieces were.
Crazy.
How crazy this. And he said that they believe the G-force that they were dropping at was like 5,000. I believe he said 5,000 Gs.
So you'd hope that those people were unconscious by the time it happened.
Yes. Okay, so the investigation afterwards, they start interviewing all the other employees, but they find no one else who had issues with Ray Thompson. All of them described him as firm but fair, which means he was probably a great boss. He left behind his wife, Dorothy, who also worked in the airline industry as a flight attendant for American Airlines. So this plane crash, 43 people died, 5 flight crew members 39 passengers, including David Burr. Among these passengers, this is kind of interesting, 53-year-old James Silla was the president of Chevron. Huh. And three other very high-level Chevron executives, Owen Murphy, Jocelyn Kemp, and Alan Swanson. And there was also three executives from Pac Bell on that flight, Pacific Wow. Bell, for people who don't Yeah. live in California. They were on board. And this actually... there was such a massive loss of high-level executives at both of these companies. It led to an industry standard change where company executives cannot fly together at the same time.
And I've always found that rule so interesting and dark and fucked up, but it came from this.
It's from this crash.
That's crazy.
Yeah. And then it made me think as I was writing this up, I was just like, at Chevron, it was like everyone at the top. So then it's like someone's weird assistant. It's like, now that guy's the president? Like, who moved up to take those places? Because that's five yeah. deep. You're down into like assistant area. You're like, yeah. who took over?
Oh, man.
They must have gotten someone from Exxon or whatever to come over. And
sure.
Two federal laws are also passed because of this, with regards to airline worker policy. The first one was that anytime an airline worker is fired or leaves their job, they have to immediately hand over their security credentials.
I mean, seems that obvious. Makes sense.
Yeah. And the second one is that no matter what, all airline employees, regardless of their position, are subject to the exact same security procedures as every other passenger on board if they're going to go onto a flight.
Total sense.
That makes super sense. And this is obviously, pre 9/11, like,
yeah.
it was such a different world.
Yeah. Who knows if they would have even found the gun if they had been doing screenings because it was so lax.
Right. Yeah. Because if a person had worked, he worked at this company for 15 years. Like, everyone probably knew this guy and liked this guy. Like,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So this is really, really tragic. Of the 43 souls who died, 26 of them, 23 passengers and three crew members, their remains could not be positively identified. Mm. So they ended up having a interdenominational mass graveside service in Los Osos, California, another city I haven't heard of. But that's right. It's basically down the mountain and kind of a little bit, it's closer to San Luis Obispo.
Yeah.
And at that service, Rabbi A. Manhoff, who was of Congregation Beth David in San Luis Obispo, spoke. And he said, quote, "Psalms and words of consolation cannot make sense of this senseless deed. Grief is a great teacher if we learn from those who loved. Take that love and use it to make the world better."
Mm.
Yeah.
And heartbreaking.
The episode of, it's a Canadian documentary series, Mayday, that details the events of this crash of Flight 1771. The episode is titled, "I'm the Problem." And that is the story of the tragedy of PSA Flight 1771.
Fuck, that's dark. Great job.
Thank you.
I'd never heard of that. And it was 86 in originated in Los Angeles. That's
87. Wild. Yeah, I know. 87. Isn't that weird? I'd never heard of it if I hadn't been collecting those weird news blurbs. That's the only reason that I knew it is because it just came up on that website of like, oh, here's the things that happened in 1987. Mm-hmm. But I didn't remember hearing it. And I don't remember the PSA crash in San Diego itself.
No. And I'm from Orange County and I don't remember ever hearing about that.
Yeah.
That's bananas. Yeah. Wow. Great job.
Thank you.
Okay, then get ready, because I'm about to do the Kent State Massacre.
Oh, shit.
I mean...
oh, man.
Yeah.
Like, now we cue the Neil Young.
Yeah. Play it. Ohio. Mm. Okay, so this came about because I'm reading this book called Chaos. It's this big old book. It's by Tom O'Neill, who's this incredible investigative journalist, and he spent 20 years researching this topic. You and I aren't really into Charles Manson and the family stories. It's like boring, and it's just a horrible person and horrible people. But this one's about Charles Manson, the CIA, and the secret history of the 60s. and like is basically like the Helter Skelter theory is fucking bullshit. Yeah. And maybe was Charles Manson a fuck it, like, you know, did the FBI put him up to this, to the murder? I mean, it's just really, really interesting and gives you this whole history of the counterculture and what went wrong.
I kind of like the fact that these days, I feel like, and a lot of people have said this, I'm definitely not the first, but it's like conspiracy theorists are so justified now because like
yeah.
back then, if you'd say, oh, Manson was hired by the FBI or the CIA or whatever, yeah. you know, people would just be like, wow, you must be totally out of your mind. And now you hear that and you're like, obviously, like,
right. Well, now because it's been so long that, and there's the Freedom of Information Act, and now, you know, the people who could have been prosecuted are all dead. So other people are speaking, are talking, and, you know, there's just, it makes more sense to me than the Helter Skelter theory. And it's an incredible book. I highly recommend it. Joe Rogan just had the author, Tom O'Neill, on his podcast, and it's just a fascinating person.
That's how you found out about Tom O'Neill, because you're doing your usually Rogan head stuff.
Yeah, you know it. No, it's weird. I posted the book one day. The next day, he was on the show. So I knew it first. No, I obviously didn't. Okay. And then when I got an Instagram message from someone named Hi From Melissa saying you should do the Kent State Massacre, it was kind of perfect timing in the, you know, it goes all the way to the top, you know, brand. So I got information. There's a from a 2015.
Is that a brand now? That brand.
Yeah. I'm a influencer, and all the way to the top influencer.
Sure.
So this there's a documentary from PBS called The Day the 60s Dies. That's really great. There's an article from the Kent State University paper by Jerry Lewis and Thomas Hensley, a Britannica article, a bunch of history.com articles. And then James Renner, who's a friend of the podcast and is a really great true crime author. He has some cool information about it as well. And then also some interviews from historian Howard Means. So in 1968, Nixon's elected to the presidency, partially on the promise of ending the increasingly unpopular Vietnam War. By the end of the 60s, there's this illusion that baby boomer generation, they were raised to believe stuff like the United States was just, like, you know, do your part and to be proud of the USA. But that kind of had fallen away there was like a cultural revolution of the student anti-war movement. And this is, I mean, you think about it now and it seems kind of normal, but that was the first generation who kind of went against what their parents wanted for them, were forcing them to do, and kind of were thinking for themselves for the very first time. And it was revolutionary, and it also incensed a large part of the population as well.
Yeah, because if you think about it, and most of people that lived in America were immigrants who had to come and like and fend for themselves, and like if they survived to have second and third generations yeah. of their family, it's because they sacrificed all that storyline. And then all of a sudden these kids were one or two generations away from that kind of suffering, and they were like, yeah, we don't have to do that. We don't have to yeah. we don't have to participate in this same thing that, right. that you guys did.
We don't have to stand for the status quo. We don't have to be treated this way. We can have a voice. And I think from their parents' generation, which went through World War II, and their, you know, grandparents through World War I, which is that you have to be so patriotic, and being anything other is you being a fucking communist. You know, it was like unheard of.
Yeah, because World War I and World War II, literally you would die if you didn't like join the war effort, if you didn't sacrifice, if you didn't do all those things.
Right.
It really was, you know, it was real.
Yeah, definitely. So by 1970, the Vietnam War split the country into two factions, those that opposed the war, those that supported it. But even a large portion of those that opposed it are really critical of the student anti-war movement. And so in November 1969, the American public finds out all these things, like about the My Lai Massacre, which is the mass murder of over 400 unarmed South Vietnamese civilians by U.S. troops. And it leads to increased opposition about the war. And then there, a month later, there's a first draft lottery since World War II, which fucking makes people lose their minds. Mm-hmm. I mean, fairly. That means people who were previously able to defer enrollment because of education are no longer exempt. So that stirs the student anti-war movement as well. You know, it's mostly blue collar, middle class students who are having to go fight in Vietnam, if you're rich, you're kind of exempt from it in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so these people are sick of seeing their childhood friends, their fellow students, their, you know, brothers being killed in a war that the majority of Americans believe getting involved in was a mistake. So they're fucking pissed and they're fighting it for their lives. It feels like it's really a passionate movement. So in his first year of his presidency, it does seem that the American involvement in Vietnam is starting to wind down, and that all changes on April 30th, 1970. Oh, by the way, May 4th is the 50-year anniversary of the Kent State Massacre. So on April 30th, 1970, Nixon goes on TV and announces the U.S. is invading Cambodia. And in fact, the Secretary of Defense didn't even know this was happening until he went on TV and announced it, which just says so much about him. And so Cambodia had been neutral up until this point. And so invading this, you know, neutral territory is obviously an escalation of the war. It enrages the anti-war movement, and college campuses around the country erupt in protest. And that sets the stage for the events that unfold at Kent State. So that's the history. And then Kent State University is around 30 miles southeast of Cleveland, 15 miles from Akron. It's a small town in Ohio. In 1970, it has about 20,000 students, and many are first-generation college students from working-class families. It's considered a somewhat conservative university as far as politics are concerned, but it does have a history of student protests and radicalization. So on Friday, May 1st, the day after Nixon's announcement, there's this widespread anger about invading Cambodia, and Kent State holds some smaller protests and rallies that are peaceful. But that night, it's almost everyone goes to like the main drag in Kent, which is tiny, and goes to the bar. They start fucking drinking and anarchy breaks out, and the protesters start, you know, lighting fucking garbage cans on fire. They're in the middle of the street. The police respond and protesters throw rocks at them and bottles, and eventually students and, you know, who the fuck knows, it could be people inciting violence for a reason. Mm-hmm. They begin to break windows and loot stores, and eventually there, more than a dozen people are arrested. The crowd's broken up with tear gas, and the students go back to campus.
You know, that's what happened in Ferguson. They would talk about that those Ferguson protests, they were trying to be peaceful, and all of a sudden there'd be like somebody would show up and they would throw something, and it was like some white guy that no one knew, ever seen before. Like that's
Kent State and Ferguson have a lot of similarities, and that's one of them. And the fact that, you know, National Guardsmen who are armed to the teeth for war are sent into civilian locations.
Yeah.
You know, it's horrific.
Which is now standard fare.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
So the next night, Saturday, May 2nd, another protest march happens on the campus. Thousands of students join in. And some people are protesting Cambodia and the Vietnam War, and some people are just students watching what's going on. So it's just like a big gathering. When the students pass the campus ROTC building, ROTC is the Reserve Officers Training Corps. So when they pass that building, that building is normally guarded by police, because obviously for people protesting the Vietnam War, that's going to be a big hotbed. But when they get there, there's no guards there. And eventually it's set on fire. But over 1,000 protesters are celebrating the building's destruction. Firefighters arrive. As the firefighters try to contain the blaze, protesters are throwing rocks at them. They slash the hoses so they can't, you know, fight the fire. It burns to the ground. Kent Mayor Leroy Satram declares a state of emergency and requests assistance from Ohio's governor. So James A. Rhodes is this fucking conservative, staunch dude. He's campaigning for the Republican nomination to run for the U.S. Senate. So he can't look soft on this. You know, he has to really, come with force. He ends up dispatching the Ohio National Guard to the campus and surrounding town. He proclaimed that the protesters are the worst type of people in America, and says, "I think we're up against the strongest, well-trained militant revolutionary group that has ever assembled in America." So he just needs to seem strong on, you know, protesters who are students, who are
throwing rocks.
Yeah. Who are 19 and 20-year-old students terrified of going to Vietnam.
Yeah. What he should have said is, "You can't tell the boys from the girls. And I don't like it." That's what
the dirty old hippies.
It was a cultural revolution where people were like, "I'm going to see what I want to be in every way that that could sentence could mean something. And yeah. the establishment was just like, holy shit, what the fuck is going on?
So the National Guard members arrive and they disperse the crowd with tear gas. That's on Saturday. And the next day, by Sunday, May 3rd, nearly 1,200 National Guardsmen occupy the Kent State campus.
Wow.
And what really should have happened was that the president of Kent State University or, you know, this conservative governor should have shut the school down at that point and you know, canceled classes for the week or whatever until order was, you know, ordered.
Resumed.
But thank you. Mm-hmm. But they didn't do that. And so on Monday, May 4th, you know, because of a lot of students were just like normal middle class kids, they'd go home for the weekend. They weren't in town. So that wasn't a lot of the people who had, you know, done these demonstrations. So they didn't even know what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
They get to school. They're going to classes. It's normal. So Monday morning, more rallies are scheduled. A crowd begins to gather, you know, and by noon, the entire Commons area contains almost 3,000 people. But it's estimated that only a fraction of them are actually like the core, hardcore demonstrators. And they're protesting at this point the presence of the guard on campus. It's not even about Cambodia as much anymore. But there's a strong anti-war sentiment. Of course. And another larger group of students are there cheering in support of those demonstrators. They're not even, you know, part of the pack, but they're supporting them. And then an additional 1,500 people are students just standing around the perimeter of the Commons because class was still in session that day, just watching. So across the Commons at the burned out ROTC building, there's about 100 Ohio National Guardsmen carrying lethal M1 military rifles. Mm. Initially, the rally's pretty peaceful, but before noon, Ohio National Guard General Robert Canterbury orders the demonstrators to disperse. Essentially, you know, Kent State Police officers are there. They're trying to get them to disperse. It doesn't work. Protesters start throwing rocks and yelling insults. And because it's a super windy day, oh, that's another thing. It was like a gorgeous day, one of the first ones of spring in this city. So it's just really eerie to have this going on then. But so, because there was some wind, the tear gas canisters they were lobbing weren't working. So it couldn't disperse the crowd. The protesters go up the steep hill, and you can see all these incredible photos from the day. They go down this hill, and the guardsmen follow and essentially get kind of blocked in by this gate that's surrounding a practice football field. So they retreat back up the hill, and as they arrive at the top of the hill, and it just seems out of fucking nowhere, 28 of the guardsmen turn around back to the crowd. They're retreating. They turn around back to the crowd and begin to fire their rifles and pistols. And there's photos of it. It's fucking eerie. Many guardsmen fire into the air or the ground, but a small portion fire directly into the crowd. And the shooting lasts for 13 seconds, which seems quick, but Mm-mm. that's a long fucking time.
Mm-mm.
Right?
That's a long time.
That's a long time.
Because one shot's a second. Like, it's
right.
like,
not even
a second.
Right. Yeah. So, and they're able to fire off 67 rounds in those 13 seconds because they have military, what's it called? Because they have military grade weapons. Eyewitness accounts from the students and faculty show that people thought that they were firecrackers, that they were shooting blanks, but instead 4 students are killed and 9 others are wounded. One of them is paralyzed from the waist down. So 20-year-old Jeff Miller, who had transferred to Kent State 4 months earlier, he's shot directly into his mouth.
Ugh.
He's 265 feet away. So that's not a threat to anyone. The bullet exits the back of his skull and he's killed instantly. And he's the one in that like heart-wrenching photo of the girl bending down.
Yep.
And that's him.
And she's screaming, right?
That's right.
Yeah.
I'll talk about her in a minute. Nearby, his friend and fellow activist, 19-year-old honor student Allison Krause, she's shot 3 times in the back as they're trying to run away. The fatal shot enters through her left arm and travels to her chest, killing her. Both those 2 students had been actively involved in the demonstration, but the other 2 fatalities, both shot at a distance of about 390 feet away, were bystanders on their way to class.
Mm.
20-year-old Sandy Schur, who was walking with one of her speech and hearing therapy students across the green, is shot through the neck and dies of blood loss. And William Schroeder, who's 19 and attending Kent State on an ROTC scholarship,
oh.
he's walking between classes when he's hit in the chest. The bullet enters his back and shatters a rib, and he dies almost an hour later at a local hospital. And so one of the National Guard, only one of them admits to actually aiming at a specific person. And that person's 18-year-old demonstrator named Joseph Lewis, because as they pointed their guns at them, he flipped them off, not knowing, obviously, that there were actual bullets in the guns. He was the closest victim of the shooting. He was a full 60 feet away. Ugh. So that was the closest person, which obviously is not a threat, right? So the argument that the National Guard was threatened, they were at least 60 feet to 390 feet away. That's not a threat.
And also none of those people had weapons. So exactly. As much as you can talk about vibes or, you know, like a group of people or whatever, it just like that doesn't really hold up to people who are standing there with machine guns or whatever whatever guns they had.
Right. And the more reading I did, the less I wanted. You can't blame the National Guard completely either. They were put in this impossible situation that the people who are higher up than them should have handled.
Yes.
They shouldn't have even put in that situation.
Right.
You know, and they are also 19, 20-year-old kids who don't have experience. So, you know, and they do feel threatened because they don't have the proper training to know what to do in a situation like that.
Yeah. And they're feeling it's like, it only takes one, when there's one side with a bunch of guns and one without, like you see it in action movies all the time or whatever, where it's like hold your fire moment, where it takes one person to fire and then other people start because they think that's what you're doing.
It's one fearful person who shoots the first, or fucking maybe there's one guy in there who's absolutely a piece of shit and starts firing and the rest of them shoot as well.
Yeah.
You know, and so.
But sorry, just as a completely uneducated outsider who has read no books and only knows about this from watching, you know, USA in the 60s types of documentaries.
Yeah.
As much as the National Guard can say, and that's obviously what official statements usually sound like, that they feel threatened. They feel threatened that someone 60 feet away might run toward them, like no matter what. Those students were unarmed. Like there's no
excuse.
That's not, it just doesn't hold water anyway.
It doesn't. No, you're absolutely right. It doesn't. That's not an excuse.
Because as threatened as you feel, that's why you have the gun in your hand. So you actually can't feel too threatened for someone who doesn't also have a gun because they can't kill you and you can kill them.
Right. They're not going to overpower you and take your gun.
Yeah.
It's just, yeah. But this guy, Joseph Lewis, later says that he had been a relatively passive participant up until this point, but he sees the military threat violence against the students. It pisses him off so much, the audacity. He personally had worked through high school to save enough money for 1 year of college, and now these men are taking over his campus, and he's so pissed off that he flips them off. Mm-hmm. And this guardsman, Larry Schaefer, raises his M1 and shoots Joseph Lewis in the stomach. And after he falls, another guardsman shoots him in the leg while he's on the ground, but he survives. But it's, you know, people were shot in the back. It seems like people were targeted. The people who were actually actively protesting somehow got shot from 300 feet away.
Clearly.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
Because the second shot, the guy flipping people off, you could maybe write off the first shot.
Right.
The second shot, what's the value of that? Like you shot someone in the stomach. It's a body hit. Like
totally. Yeah. That's shoot to kill, too. If you shoot someone in the stomach. So in the chaos that follows the shooting, the guard returns to the commons and there a full riot is threatening to break out. This hasn't fucking de-escalated yet, but thank God the faculty marshals led by Glenn Frank, a geology professor, truly, I mean, they're the heroes of that day. They successfully persuade students not to endanger their lives by taking on the guard, because now these students are fucking pissed and worked up. You know, they see their fellow students bleeding from the head So I looked at our My Favorite Murder email, and Laura R., her mom was there that day, and she wrote to us. Laura wrote to us and said that her mom said, thank God for the professors who stepped in. She says, putting themselves in danger and to try to de-escalate the situation. The guard was saying they would shoot again if everyone did not immediately get inside. So the professors were out there with bullhorns, and you can hear the recordings of them yelling, and they sound like they're about to fucking cry. And they're just shoving students into whatever building they could keep them out, to keep them out of harm's way, like just trying to get them to disperse. And she says, my mom was ushered into a random dorm and assigned a random room with a few other girls in order to stay in the room until further notice. And then she says, once the whole shooting scene was cleared, they told all the students they had 2 hours to get their shit and leave campus indefinitely.
Wow.
And then if you weren't gone within the allotted 2 hours, you would officially be under martial law. So then University President Robert White orders the university closed, and it remains closed for 6 weeks. So photographs of the dead are distributed, and all these powerful photos are distributed in newspapers all over the world. Newsweek reports that a story, an article headlined, My God, They're Killing Us. And the cover features a photo of 14-year-old runaway Mary Ann Vacheco. She's the one who's screaming in anguish, kneeling over Jeff Miller's dead body. The photograph was taken by Kent State photojournalism student John Philo. He wins a fucking Pulitzer Prize and that for that photo. And it becomes the most like enduring image of the of Kent State and also of the Vietnam War, like one of the most lasting images of the protests.
Absolutely.
In the following weeks, over 400 colleges and high schools and 4 million students across the country lead strikes and demonstrations against the shooting and the Cambodia invasion. At the University of Wisconsin-Madison, a campus known for radicalism, there's 20 firebombings. There's militant activism. I mean, people are just fucking losing their shit. People who weren't involved before, you know, students are now just protesting this. And, you know, a lot of the colleges are canceled for the rest of the year, etc. So Nixon and his administration's public reaction to the shootings are perceived as callous. Nixon says, quote, when dissent turns to violence, it invites tragedy. Essentially, don't dissent and there won't be fucking violence, yeah, is what he's saying.
Right. No matter what's happening in your country, don't dissent or we get to kill you.
All right. And then there's tragedy. So great job, dissent. You know, just 5 days after the shooting, 100,000 people demonstrate in Washington, D.C. It's the size of the strike, which is pretty peaceful, it stirs Nixon. So Nixon, I mean, God, watch this documentary, but he goes out to the Lincoln Memorial and meets with student protesters and acknowledges them as citizens and not bums, which he had called them before the shooting. Mm-hmm. And he kind of is like, I understand your concerns, and kind of validates them, which is shocking. And on May 14th, in a much less publicized event, another on-campus shooting results in the deaths of 2 students and the wounding of 12 others. It's at Jackson State University in Mississippi. This time, law enforcement officers fire more than 150 rounds in 30 seconds into a woman's dormitory while the students were protesting. They went in there, they shot 150 rounds in 30 seconds.
Holy shit.
Why haven't you heard about it?
It was a black university.
That's right.
Is that right?
And the students who were killed were black. So, of course, the event is largely ignored by the media. But it's also important to note that the surge in anti-war sentiment leads to a rise of pro-war supporters known as the silent majority. Ugh. These people who were the silent majority, who were just kind of, you know, not super political, living their lives. Now they want to show support of the U.S. and they end up handing Nixon a landslide victory in the 1972 presidential election. Essentially, it caused all these people who were somewhat conservative, but not totally. A lot of them were Democrats who weren't really interested in politics to rally to show their disdain. They were almost voting for Nixon to show their disdain for the anti-war movement, mm-hmm, you know,
yeah,
people who might not have even voted. So, of course, there's all these investigatory commissions and court trials that follow that I won't get into. But they're trying to answer whether the National Guard was under sufficient threat to use force. And they testify that they felt the need to discharge their weapons because they feared for their life. But there is a civil suit by the injured Kent State students and their families, and a settlement was reached in 1979, and the National Guard of Ohio agreed to pay those injured in the events $675,000, which is like, I think, $5 million or something in today's money.
Oh, wow.
So November 1974, 8 former guardsmen are acquitted of violating the civil rights of the students by a U.S. district court. So they're acquitted.
Sounds like the silent majority was on that court.
It does, doesn't it?
Yeah.
The anti-war protests draw to an end when Nixon begins to withdraw the U.S. soldiers from Vietnam in 1973, basically ends the U.S. involvement in the Vietnam War. But the Kent State shootings continue to reverberate through society. And our culture, because two people who were at Kent State that day, two art students, Mark Mothersbaugh and Jerry Casale, they react to their friend, like they were friends with some of the people who were killed, and they form their band Devo.
Devo.
Devo. The band's philosophy is that mankind has hit a wall in evolution and is now evolving in reverse, i.e. de-evolution.
Devo. Oh, is that really what that means?
De-evolution.
They couldn't have been more right.
I mean, it's still crappening. Jerry Casale of Devo has been quoted as saying, "All I can tell you is that it completely and utterly changed my life. I was a white hippie boy, and then I saw exit wounds from M1 rifles out of the backs of two people I knew. I would not have started the idea of Devo unless this happened." And Chrissy Hynde was also there of the Pretenders.
Are you serious?
She went to school. Yeah, she was there that day as well. She went to school at Kent State.
Whoa.
And was friends with some of the murdered students. I know. So every year since 1971, on the anniversary of the shooting, it's been commemorated with a candlelight procession around the campus and an all-night vigil at the sites where the students fell. And in January of 2017, the site of the shooting on Kent State campus is declared a National Historic Landmark. So this year, on May 4th, it would have been the 50th anniversary of the shootings. They were going to have this whole speech and ceremonies and all this shit. And then COVID-19 came around, so it's not going to happen. And some of the survivors were going to speak. Historian John Fitzgerald O'Hara says that the Kent State massacre became a source of public trauma, and it came to symbolize the fracturing of the social body and the breakdown of democracy. And that is the murder of Jeffrey Miller, Alison Krauss, William Schroeder, and Sandra Schur, aka the Kent State massacre.
Wow.
How fucked up is that?
Oof.
How do we not know more about this? You know, it's like a paragraph in our history books in high school, and that's it.
Well, I mean, I think, yeah, it is also the kind of thing where the 60s were such a bizarre time that, like, when, like, I think young people these days, it's just like we're so far away from it that it's all been boiled down to, like, peace, love, and, like, you know, mm-hmm. bell-bottom jeans or whatever, when actually it was all, you know, those were young people that were like, yeah, it shouldn't be like this. And you can't just ship us off. You can't just ship us off when, like, half the people you're shipping off don't have voting rights, or, you know what I mean? Like, that kind of shit, like this stuff Muhammad Ali stood up for. I mean, it's just like, people finally got to start saying, yeah, you don't just get to sacrifice me.
Right. I got to have a say in my life, in my country's life, in, you know, in the decisions that are being made that affect us specifically, not, you know, these people in the White House or their sons. It's fucking us that are going to war for this.
None of us,
you know,
yeah, doesn't affect their sons.
No, exactly. I highly recommend reading this book, Chaos, if you want to know more about. I guess that's why I've had like a hard time this past couple weeks, is that, I mean, everything is fucked and nothing is real. And we've been lied to for fucking decades. And it's really shitty.
Yeah. OK, we're going to switch you over to some Jackie Collins after this, where you can just how about a little Harold Robbins.
I need to start listening to Bananas before bed.
No, I mean, like,
this isn't helping me.
It's funny because you're right. It's like, this is the time where, oh, I have all this time. I can finally read these books I should read. This, like,
right.
I have the same feeling you do, is I should know this and I should get into this.
Yeah.
And we should, maybe in the fall. You know what I mean? We're in a bit of a hot spot time right now where it's like, I don't know of a chaos. It's like, I started watching The Leftovers right as, like, they were talking about, you know, this this
great show,
this whole thing starting. And I was like, I don't think this is a good idea for me.
No, terrible idea. You know what I've been falling? You know what I've been falling asleep to at night? Station 11. You know that fucking post-apocalyptic story where there's a big flu called the Georgia flu that hits the and just fucking decimates the world, and now people live off the grid. And
no, I haven't heard of this at all. Oh, what channel?
It's one of it's a book called Station 11 by
a female writer.
Yeah.
Yes. Sorry.
You've read it. I think you and I have talked about it.
I haven't read it. Someone recommended it to me because they said it's like the is like she predicted it happening in the
she
book.
She did. It came out years ago in 2015. It came out in 2014. It's a gorgeous book, Station 11 by Emily St. John Mandel. I love it. It's not for the faint of heart right now, but buy it and put it on your bookshelf.
It's a fun Christmas book.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. Just time
it's
your shit
out.
It's
one of my favorite books. Right. It's
yeah. I hear it's unbelievable. Honestly.
It's incredible.
Yeah.
Read it.
Wow. That was great. And
Thank you. I'm
glad to know those details of, I did not know they actually burned down the ROTC building. That wasn't anything that I knew. I mean, I knew is the very basics of the amount of people that killed, the fact that the National Guard just turned and started shooting at unarmed students. I mean, it's just like
the turned part really got to me too, because you could have just kept walking. You were not being, what's the word?
Pursued?
You were being, well.
Threatened?
They were, what's it called when you get into a corner? They weren't
cornered? Sorry.
They weren't, no, it's good, leave it. They weren't being cornered. They could have kept walking. They were about to go over a hill. So the canisters of tear gas that the protesters were throwing back at them wouldn't have hit, and they turned and started shooting.
Because that comes in, that's like ego and pride. It's like, I'm sorry if I become a full-on nutso Buddhist, but like it's we have to solve the problems in ourselves so that we can solve the problems in the world, because that's how those things start, is people with power, whether that means you have the gun or you're the person that has the most money or you're the person with the voice, when those people can't relate anymore or don't want to relate as human beings to the people that they are, that are under them, that's when shit goes nuts. And it's like the idea that somebody in a campus, an open campus with tons of people, it's like whoever you were mad at, you knew for a fact, if you were trained with guns, you knew for a fact that shooting toward the person you were mad at meant you were also shooting toward 20 people who are totally innocent and not involved. Right. And you knew that as a fact, and you did it anyway because you were pissed, because these people were insulting you and your lifestyle and what you've decided was important. Like, it's all personal shit. It's mishandled personal shit.
God, I love when you drink coffee.
That you was suddenly great. Start to make sense.
That was so good.
I don't know. I don't. That's all I can. Because I don't. Obviously, I'm not. I don't know anything historical. I don't know how most things work. But we should. It's like. But I do understand human
behavior,
human failure. Because we've all done it. We've all done a thing where we take a thing personally that actually has nothing to do with us, and we interject ourselves incorrectly, and then we fuck it up. We become the wrench.
We react
in the fucking wheel. Yes.
Yeah.
And then we make it a thing that it doesn't need to be, because we want that, like, we want it's righteous indignation, or it's superiority. Yeah. It's that kind of stuff that's deadly. It's deadly to us. It's deadly to other people. Sorry.
Absolute power.
Yeah.
Corrupts absolutely. Motherfucker.
Oh, Steven, you're fired.
Also, buy a Devo album, everyone. They're fucking incredible.
My friend.
Did you just fire Steven?
I fired Steven on the show. On the show, and you didn't even care. You didn't even hear it.
I don't give a shit. No,
Steven.
No, Steven.
The best part about this is on this Zoom meeting, you guys, Steven's background is that cartoon panel with the dog sitting at the table with the room on fire saying it's fine.
This
so
is
Steven
fine.
Is sitting in a cartoon burning room.
Yeah.
And he just, when I said he was fired, he just dropped his face into his hands like, oh no.
Not again.
Don't take it. it, Steven. Fight the power.
Yeah, really.
Fight the power. We're the power.
Steven's like, this is the 11th time you fired me on air. Please stop it.
Oh, hi, Elvis.
All right. So
should we do?
Yeah, let's fucking hooray the fuck out of this thing.
Oh, we need it.
Yeah.
All right. Okay. We're going to read you your fucking hoorays. If you want to contribute, I get them off of Instagram when people respond to this week's episode's post. You get them off Twitter.
We get them off Twitter, Instagram, and then, of course, in the fan cult, if you post them, Jay pulls them down off of that, too. So any way you feel like doing it, we will find them.
Okay. My hashtag fucking hooray is that me and my boyfriend had our 6-month anniversary yesterday over FaceTime. Oh, this is from Kells C95. And we each got drunk and chilled out for 2.5 hours. For me, it's a big thing because he's only my second ever relationship. I'm 24 years old and my first relationship was incredibly emotionally manipulative and abusive and left me with so much baggage that I've spent the last 4 years working through. But I feel like I'm finally learning to trust again. And I'm so happy with my boyfriend now. Fucking hooray for a healing and healthy relationship with a person who genuinely loves me, messiness and all.
Oh.
Amen.
That's awesome. Congratulations.
I love that.
That's the dream right there.
It is.
Who likes this mess?
Shout out to Vince.
Oh, man. Shout out to Vince for me, too. He loves me in his own way. That's lovely. Yeah. Let's see. This one's from Amanda. Her handle is Abnormal Amanda.
Amen.
I just saw that. Welcome, Amanda. This says, a wonderful fucking hooray is my friend Simone, who accidentally started a nonprofit during this pandemic. It's called Invisible Hands, and it's a volunteer grocery delivery service for elderly and immunocompromised people who can't leave their homes in New York and New Jersey. She started it with a few friends just to help out, and she now has, all caps, thousands of volunteers servicing New York and New Jersey. She's been doing it 24 hours a day, every day for the past month, and the need her organization is filling in this area is truly incredible. Thanks for listening, SSDGM. Holy shit,
oh
Simone.
My God.
You are a badass.
Chills and tears floating in my eyes.
What a beautiful
Helping Hands.
It's Invisible Hands. It's a nonprofit, and it clearly takes volunteers, and it has thousands. I mean, that's the beautiful
incredible.
Part. People want to help each other. People love each other. Do not buy into everything that gets shown on the news of people hating each other and screaming at each other and fighting things. The majority of this country has coalesced in the most magnificent way, and that doesn't get on the news because people aren't, that doesn't scare anybody, and it doesn't tick up ratings when you show a bunch of people going, yeah, thousands of people are volunteering for Invisible Hands. Man,
it's so fucking true. It's so fucking true.
It's so true. So congratulations.
That's incredible.
That's so kick-ass. You guys are awesome. Invisible
incredible.
Hands, Simone.
This is from Jordan Thai, T-H-I.
Oh, I thought it was T-H-I-G-H.
Hey. My fucking array. Hey, girl. My fucking array is that after a couple years of infertility struggles, I gave birth to our first baby. I was worried to have a baby during this weird time for many reasons. That's the first thing I thought of is people who are pregnant right now. That's got to be rough.
So scary.
But need to shout out the maternity nurses at Altman Hospital in Canton, Ohio.
Hey.
Hey, girls.
Girls, you're doing it big time.
Ooh. I know that this is an incredibly hard time to be in the healthcare industry, but they all made me and my husband feel so welcome and so well taken care of during a scary time of not only birth, but during a pandemic such as this. Mm-hmm. We will forever be grateful for their support, knowledge, courage, and encouragement to bring our little girl into the world and help us feel confident to take care of her.
Aww. Say the name of the hospital again.
It's Altman, A-U-L-T, Altman Hospital in Canton, Ohio.
A-U-L-T?
M-A-N.
Yeah, sorry.
Altman, yeah.
Amazing job, everybody at Altman Hospital, maternity ward, NICU, whatever, wherever you were. Thank you so much for showing up at work every day and putting your life on the line for everybody else.
We appreciate it.
We really do. And how about those fucking rad ass nurses that have started showing up at those protests to counter protest, and they just show up with their arms crossed and scrubs and stand in the middle of it's one of
no.
the.
No.
Yeah. Again, it's the kind of thing that they've, like, you see little pictures of it here and there on the internet, but like they're not covered. They should be covering that of just like
yeah.
the healthcare workers that are going down to say, actually, they did today. A bunch of healthcare workers stood in the Capitol. I can't remember if it was in front of the White House or where, and just read off names of healthcare workers who died because of coronavirus on the job, just reading them out loud. Cause it's like, you think this is fake? You're trying to tell people yeah. this is fake. Here's all the people who have died.
Nobody's having a fucking blast during this time. And so there's like rules and regulations, and we need to just fucking sit back and let the people who are good at their jobs and who know what they're doing handle it, and stop being little brats about, you know, their hair. Like, there was something about, oh, forget, take that out.
The lady with the roots.
Yeah. And then Tim Robinson saying, this is when I start buying my Halloween decorations.
What about, are you telling me I'm not supposed to buy my Halloween decorations? I must have watched that fucking, I love him
so funny. What's his show called? We've been
Detroiters.
Watching it lately. No, the other one. He has one, like a sketch show.
Oh, I think you should leave.
That's what it's called. Detroiters is my favorite thing.
Yeah, both. Okay.
All. Okay.
Tim Robinson. So let's just shout out to Tim Robinson as well.
We'll lump him
into the healthcare workers. That's not rude or disrespectful at all. Hold, please.
Okay. Oh, yeah, go.
Check this shit out. This is from Kat and Karen. With an eye. 900 days ago, I was dope sick for the last time. 900 days ago, I could only focus on getting through the next second and then the next. But those seconds turned into minutes, turned into hours, turned into days, turned into months, turned into years. My life didn't become perfect the moment I became sober. I have always been prone to depression and melancholy, and I still am. But no matter what happens today, I know I won't steal, cheat, or lie in order to get high. And at the end of each day, no matter how shitty, that is always a fucking hooray. 900 days sober. Oh, Holy shit. Congratulations.
Every one of these are giving me chills. That is incredible.
It's beautiful. It's beautiful. Yeah. And it's a whole new life. Congratulations, Kat and Karen.
Amazing.
Good job.
I'm just amazed.
Yeah. It's really impressive.
This is my last one. This is from ramblerose.co. I'm a watercolor artist, and since being in quarantine, I have been painting greeting cards, writing uplifting notes, and sending them to nursing homes to be distributed amongst the elderly who are possibly the most lonely ones out there right now, often with no family or friends, and definitely no one allowed to visit them. It might only be a small act, but it's bringing me joy to hopefully send a little joy to those older people who are so lonely. And it's a win-win because painting is therapeutic for me, bringing me a sense of accomplishment and joy to craft these cards and know that they are being put to use. We have to remember during this time that although being, quote, productive is wonderful, we also have to be kind to ourselves and do all we can to handle our own emotions with care, whether that's laying on the couch for 10 hours or becoming the next Einstein. It's whatever makes you happy, calm, centered, and of course, sexy.
Genius.
That's incredible.
That's very lovely and beautiful.
I love having a craft and like use it. Wait, I forgot we're recording a podcast. I'm like, I wish I had a craft that I could send out to the world and make people happy.
Maybe if this involved a little more wool, you would see it as your craft. This is literally your craft.
Oh shit, just fucking running my stupid mouth, my stupid sailor mouth.
Yeah, too bad. You get to. Too bad. Can't be that stupid. Here's mine. And this is nuts because Avalon Monroe sent it to us. And I just need to preface this one by saying my friend and friend of the podcast, Guy Branum, months ago recommended, texted me and was like, you have to watch the Bon Appetit cooking videos. It's the Bon Appetit Test Kitchen YouTube channel. And,
okay.
And
Steven seems to like it.
I've literally been binging this for the last month. I was watching it before we recorded today. I'm obsessed.
Oh my God, I have to watch it.
I'm completely completely obsessed. Now here's but I do want to preface this, because the reason I picked this is because this just happened. Basically, guy asked me to start watching this 6 months ago. I can't ever do anything anyone tells me, and we all know. So like 3 days ago, I was like, it was like I had gotten up at 5 a.m. wandering in my house like a weird ghost. I was like, oh, wait a second. I know it'll make me feel better. I click onto this video. I just go on randomly and I'm like, that guy's cute. And I start watching Brad Leone, I assume you pronounce his name that way, explain how to make bruschetta, which is a food I'm obsessed with.
Sure.
He is my full-on boyfriend. He is he also made this amazing dish so quickly and easily, and he's one of the most compelling people I've ever seen on TV, on YouTube. I was immediately hooked. I immediately text Guy and I'm like, I finally did it. I'm in. Guy then sends me an email, basically a syllabus saying, watch these videos in this order and then get back to me. Like, a full thing. I will, for sure. And then he actually today tweeted about it, saying, I sent Karen this email and then I sent it to this other Karen. What other Karens need to know about the Bon Appetit test kitchen? And then as I'm scrolling through the fucking arrays, here's this one. Okay. From Avalon Monroe. Hello, all. I've been struggling with insomnia even before this whole pandemic BS started. And now it's even worse. Considering I'm moving less and my sleep schedule is pretty much in the drain, I've been listening to a lot of MFN and I'm running out of episodes to binge and also watch videos from the Bon Appetit Test Kitchen. I love, love, love all the videos and the series they make. It's super calming and relaxing and generally sends me right to sleep when I'm not glued to the screen, as they temper chocolate, make stock, or do general kitchen things. I feel like I'm living vicariously through them as they work up wonders of food, and all of the chefs' calm, happy demeanors help me feel a little bit better about the current situation. Thanks for being you and continuing to commit to the work you do. I appreciate you supporting everyone in the community and local businesses. You guys really are helping a lot of us through this difficult time. With much love, SSDGM, Avalon Monroe, in parentheses, from Toronto. Oh, not the Avalon Monroe from
Boston? Or
yeah, Austin. Isn't
that
crazy?
Beautiful. I have to watch it.
It's, you can go on to the Bon Appetit Test Kitchen YouTube channel, click on any video, you start to get to know. There's about six chefs that are in there telling you, here's our recipe, here's how we make it, we make it easy, this, that, the other. It's, and they're the most, every person that comes on screen, you want to be friends with them. You love hearing them talk. They're so, cooking is such a mystery to me. And watching
so
Brad make this bruschetta, I was like, I'm going to make bruschetta. I literally was like, I'm making that tomorrow.
I love it.
I have so
That's
many
amazing.
Roma tomatoes in my kitchen right now. Hopefully they don't go bad. Hopefully I do it. But it's just like, it feels like it's for a reason. Like it's going to help something. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like I'm actually learning. But then you just adore the people. They're so.
I learned how to cook from watching people cook on TV.
Yeah,
shout
right.
Shout out Rachel Ray. Yeah.
Yeah, you know sure. all about that food channel
that's
stuff.
That's right.
I don't have to tell you.
I had a job.
speaking
until
of Canada.
You found
your craft.
That's right. That I didn't know I had. Speaking of Canada, we want to give a warm shout out to the Murderinos and everyone in Nova Scotia there for the tragedy that they're currently going through.
Yeah, there's a terrible shooting there. So we've heard about it from a bunch of you guys, you listeners that are up there in Canada and particularly in Nova Scotia. So the Halifax Murderino group, we just want to let you guys know we're thinking about you and, you know, you're not alone.
That's right. Thanks for listening, everyone. This has been a real long episode.
Has it? Oh my God, again. Again, we've done it again.
Doing that? I mean,
look, what, we're not busy. And
listen,
we know you aren't either. So shut up and
right.
take your 2-hour episode.
Yeah. Thank you. We're so hashtag blessed. Thank you guys for listening.
Yeah. It's really nice to actually have something to mark time and look forward to doing and, you know, and to be doing this with you. Thanks for doing it with us. Stephen, thank you for everything. Oh, and happy birthday, Stephen.
Oh, thank you.
Last week. It was last week.
We didn't say it on the show last week because we're self-involved and we apologize.
Like, I took a day off and I watched Waterworld and took a nap, so it was very nice.
Oh, that's right. You were
amazing.
Gone.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm going to blame it on you.
Off.
You were gone, so you don't get to have birthday wishes.
Dang it.
Happy birthday, Stevie. Stephen. Stevie.
Stevie.
Tell everyone happy birthday, Stevie, please. If you didn't already. And other than that, stay sexy.
And don't get murdered.
Goodbye.
Hold on. He's right here. Ooh. Elvis.
Nice.
I just dropped the Zoom. Elvis, you want a cookie?
There we go. That worked.
That was perfect.
Good boy. Okay, great. Was I recording? I was.
Cool.
Great.